Welcome to Propaganda Loves You, the show that asks and answers the question, whose story is this anyway? I'm Joe, your host for this week, and I'm joined by Cody and Arthur. We're big boys with big feelings about history, and today we're going to talk about them.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Welcome to Propaganda Loves You. My name is Joe. Before we get started with the main segment this week, there are a few things we want to share. What I want you guys to know this week is that meditation probably saved my life, and I'm not being too dramatic about that. Like most military veterans, I've worked through a lot of depression and anxiety, and some of that's related to service, some of it's just life-related. We all deal with it in different ways. But a lot of young men, and especially a lot of military veterans, struggle with depression, and a lot of people lose their lives every year to suicide. And so finding ways for us to manage these things in a healthy way that allows us to stay engaged with our communities is really important. There are many different therapies, medicines you can do. I've been on medication before. I've gone to therapy before. I found both of them helpful at different times in my life. You should definitely try those out if you haven't. Talk to your doctors about those options. But for my own experience, a daily meditation practice has done more for my depression and anxiety and mental health than anything else I've tried. So if you've been curious about trying meditation in your own life and you haven't just given it a shot for whatever reason, consider this your sign to give it a shot. You don't have to pay any money to get started. There are free websites and apps with a ton of content to help you through all of the beginning processes of learning meditation. Insight Timer is the most popular mobile app people use. And websites, there are Audio Dharma and then Dharma Seed are two really big free database kind of websites. And they both also have mobile apps you can use. So this is just your subtle sign to give that a shot. If you haven't done it yet, hit us up in the comments or whatever else if you want to know more about it. I'd love to talk about it. Cody, what's going on with you this week?
Not politically connected at all, but I thought I'd missed the pond skimming event at Whiteface this year, but I didn't because they moved it. So that was yesterday. So we got to go watch people try to make it across the pond on skis and snowboards. We didn't stay for the full thing, but you know, there's a lot of people just crashing into a small pond. So that was also fun to watch.
Were they all on the same type of skis? Did anybody build any, you know, contraptions?
No contraptions that I saw. A lot of good outfits, though. We were really hoping to see like a blown up dinosaur, but I'm pretty sure that'd be like a drowning hazard or something. But yeah, it was a good event. The snow was still pretty good for skiing, like considering it's April 12th or whatever that we went out there. So they might be open another couple weekends.
I've never tried to skim a pond before.
I kind of wanted to do it. Like last year, we went to Gore and saw their pond skimming event. A lot of people made it across that because they had a lot of runway. But the one at Whiteface, for some reason, they didn't seem to have as much runway and the snow was really wet. So people couldn't get any speed at all going down to it. But yeah, maybe I'll try it next year. But I'd probably go to Gore because I think I got a better chance of making it across their pond.
It sounds really fun. I really enjoy watching those. Like whenever I'm at a hotel flipping through cable and there's like a Red Bull event on and they're trying to like ride a bike off a jump, whatever.
Yeah,
I love that.
Well, that's what we were talking about while we were watching is like, can we make like a squirrel suit?
Yeah, it's always fun to watch that. And also if there's a little bit of danger involved too, it makes it more interesting. Like I've seen the one where it's like they had this log that's really long and like slightly inclined and people are trying to run all the way across it before they jump into the water, but it's like 20 or 30 feet and their feet are wet because, I don't know, the log is wet. And so they're just trying to run sideways across the log and just eating shit every time they do. It's kind of funny.
It's like that chase the cheese down the hill, you know? What is that, European one?
Yes.
Yeah, that one seems dangerous. I saw some documentary on it and yeah, they were bruised up.
It's like CK? I can't even remember what it was called. That Japanese game show that was always on, like redubbed for the US. And they're just like constantly going through these crazy obstacle courses. Same thing. Just watching people.
I loved watching that.
Yeah.
There was one I used to watch on Shift Work. I can't remember the name of it, but yeah, just like
big shallow pools of water with soft obstacle courses built on top.
Yeah.
Just getting punched in the face by a foam fist.
Yeah. Most extreme elimination challenge.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, yeah. And like in the original Ninja Warrior, yeah. Like in Japan or whatever, when they would show that too, that was good.
Yeah, the US versions of those shows just don't capture the same. It's just not quite the same feel, for sure.
Good slapstick.
Yeah. Arthur, anything you want to talk about from last week?
Yeah, this week it seemed like it was fraught with a lot of news of the stock market, a lot of the economy. It was in the headlines. One of the most surprising things of the week, at the southern border of the United States now, we're deploying troops. How about that?
Yep.
What's the official title
of like what they're actually doing? Take control of the border buffer zone, the southern border, deploy a striker
battalion. This is buffer zone?
Yeah, that's what they're saying.
It uses that word?
Yeah.
That's literally the same language Israel uses whenever they create a new area around Gaza or even in southern Lebanon. They have this so-called safety buffer zone where they just stake out like a 30-mile range along the borderline and like, oh, all this whole section is ours now. Big yikes.
Yeah, using the same exact language there. Yeah. This is after multiple times that the Mexican government has basically come back and been like, don't do strikes in our country, like pretty vehemently against that multiple times. We should definitely talk about that, probably like to track that, just see how that changes and whatnot. I was also thinking, Joe, you mentioned last week that you were doing a volunteer event that ended up happening. I saw some stuff online. I think it was part of the April 5th protests that basically, like, it was a big group of people that were rolling out like this really massive list, I think, of like all the people that have been killed in Gaza so far. Was that part of the same protest, or was that just something different that was also happening in DC at the time?
Well, I know on April 5th, there was the big like anti-Trump organized protests the same day the Palestinian Youth Movement is like the national nonprofit that organizes a lot of the protests, but they had planned like a national march for Palestine Day. And they've done that before. The one big protest I went to in November 2023, they also had a banner of list of all the names that had been killed so far. And I'm sure they did the same thing now, and it's a lot longer. I've looked at, like, you can look at a document with just pages and pages of names, and it has the ages beside them. And, like, the document I looked at was, like, many, 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 maybe 100 pages of names. But the first 6 pages lists of names were just age 0. Like, kids under 1 year old who had been killed in strikes. It's a great example of powerful rhetoric in a protest, like a way to demonstrate a point that just really hits you like a brick mm-hmm. when you realize what they're representing. I did not go to the Saturday protests. I stayed home and did chores around the house that day. This past Thursday, the 10th, I volunteered with a group called Drop Site News. Drop Site News is a reader-funded, relatively new online newsroom. They do investigative journalism about war and foreign policy. They've had some journalists on the ground in Gaza, like people from Gaza, write reports for them about what's going on. The main guy who is involved with it, his name's Ryan Grimm. I've been following him for a while, and he does good journalistic work. But he was there at the event, so we met in D.C., to organize everything. The purpose of the event, Drop Site News had purchased 535 copies of a book called If I Must Die. This book is titled after a poem that the author Rifat Alarir had written a couple of months before he died. He wrote it the week after the recent October 7th Hamas attack happened, and then Israel launched their retaliation campaign. It was recently after that started that he wrote this poem. In December of 2023, he was killed in an airstrike in Gaza. The poem kind of predicts the circumstances of his own death. It's called If I Must Die, and he talks about what he wants people to do with his work and his name. He was a poet, a writer, and a professor in, I don't remember the name of the university. It's been destroyed now, but it's also in Gaza. I actually taught this poem to my community college students, I think in like February or March of 2024, after I found out about it. The book is a collection of his poetry and some of his prose, some essays and stuff, and one of his students sort of compiled it and got it published. I thought that was kind of cool because for my dissertation work, I studied posthumous novels. I studied novels that were published after their author had died. And so this publication is kind of a interesting literary event for me because that's like the kind of thing I like to study. I was really excited to join Dropsite News, and we all met. They had it very organized. You'd sign up into teams. I joined two other volunteers. We were each given 9 books in a bag and a little pamphlet that explained what they wanted us to say and everything, and a list of offices to hit. So we had 25 or 30 congressional house offices to go to, Democrats and Republicans. And we went to the Rayburn Building. I've never been to any of the big congressional buildings before, but it was kind of wild just to see the building inside and everything. We walked around the halls in Congress. We'd go up to a door. We'd walk in. There's usually an intern sitting there, 19, 20-year-old kid, like very, very young people. I was surprised by that. And so they didn't want us like lobbying or arguing with people. We basically would walk in and we'd say, hey, is the representative available? They'd say, no, they are flying home or doing whatever. And we would say, well, this is a gift from Dropsite News Readers. It's a book, all the stuff I just explained. And I would add the point that it's a testament, the book itself, you should read it. It's interesting. Talk to each other about it. It's a gift, not just for the representative, but for you staffers as well, because a lot of young people are more easily able to connect with this issue, I think, than older people are. And I would say that, you know, it's a representation of good literature, of course, but it's also a testament to what the human spirit can do, what the human being is able to continue to do to produce art in the face of like unimaginable hardship. And that would kind of get them a lot of times. They would be like, oh, okay. Some of them were kind of dismissive, like, yeah, hurry up, whatever. A mix of both. It's kind of interesting to see the different kinds of offices you go to and all the different virtue signaling the different representatives have. Like, I don't know, there's this one, I can't remember which representative it was, but it was from some like plain state, like maybe Montana or something, a Republican representative, but they had like a big mounted deer head with like full rack of antlers in the office. And I was just like, this is wild to just walk into Congress and see this. But really cool, really, really enjoyable experience. It felt a lot more effective as a protest kind of thing than just showing up in public, screaming a lot and going home, actually giving real people who are connected to power things that might influence their opinion. Felt a lot more useful to do. So that was fun. I enjoyed doing that a lot.
I really liked it. That sounds really fun to get directly involved and to go to the offices.
Is that organization, Dropsite News, I'm assuming it's national, but like that was an event they did in DC. Could other people get involved with events that they've got going on? Is that like a common thing that they've got volunteering for?
They're a really new organization as a news organization. I think they started last year. So, I mean, they might have a dozen or fewer people on paid staff at this point. Yeah, I think they are more interested in kind of direct strategic things like that. This was something that they directly fundraised for and got all the funds together to purchase all the copies before they organized a volunteer effort. But yeah, if you haven't heard of it, Dropsite News, look them up, give them a follow or something. Really good organization.
Similar to you, Joe, I did not make it out on the 5th. I had already had plans, but I think the thing that was impressive to me about the 5th, like I didn't realize how many towns, like small towns, would have things going on. Like I live in a town with less than 5,000 people in it. I didn't realize that they had a hands-off event like in my town. Like we were actually in Burlington for the weekend. There was a big protest going on in Burlington, like walking up and down Church Street. So it was like, and I think Plattsburgh too, that we had to go through. So like every town that we basically hit had some sort of protest going on. So that was pretty cool.
Please stay tuned for a word from our sponsors. Hey, question for you. How do you stay informed these days? Because everything out there is pure chaos,
right? One second it's a news story, the next it's a conspiracy theory, and suddenly your uncle's got a manifesto.
That's why I only use Obey, the app that keeps your feed clean, clear, and compliant.
Same! Obey's friendly moderation team filters out all the dangerous noise, stuff that might make you uncomfortable, confused, or worse, think for yourself.
Plus, the curated discussion threads? So streamlined. No arguments, no messy facts, just approved perspectives presented by verified voices.
And with Obey, misinformation never gets in your way. Like, ever. It's like the truth, but smarter?
But why wait? If you're not on Obey,
do you even exist?
Join the millions of satisfied users and let Obey guide your digital experience.
We've got a couple things that we're going to cover in today's show, a main section, which we're going to be talking about propaganda through history, how that looks. One thing that I did want to talk about today before we get into the episode, because I think it does actually play really well with these two episodes that we're about to have, is a recent executive order that came out from the Trump administration regarding how we are representing American history at the Smithsonian Institute, which ties directly into what we're going to talk about, because we're going to talk about history. Like I mentioned, Joe's going to host a main segment here this week and next week. This was one of the first episodes that we actually recorded. I think it might have been the first episode we recorded. Joe, you mentioned a few ads, too, that you're going to hear through the episode that we recorded well before the executive order that came out. I'm just going to read a majority of the fact sheet from the EO, not the EO itself. This executive order came out on March 27th. This fact sheet called President Donald J. Trump Restores Truth and Sanity to American History. Today, President Donald J. Trump signed an executive order restoring truth and sanity to American history by revitalizing key cultural institutions and reversing the spread of divisive ideology. Now, President Trump aims to ensure that the Smithsonian Institute is an institute that sparks children's imagination, celebrates American history and ingenuity, serves as a symbol of the world to the world of American greatness, and makes America proud. The order directs the vice president, who is a member of the Smithsonian Board of Regents, to work to eliminate improper, divisive, or anti-American ideology from the Smithsonian and its museums, education and research centers, and the National Zoo. The order directs the administration to work with Congress to ensure that future Smithsonian appropriations prohibit funding for exhibits or programs that degrade shared American values, divide Americans by race, or promote ideologies inconsistent with federal law. And number two, celebrates women's achievements in the American Women's History Museum and do not recognize men as women. The vice president will work with congressional leaders to appoint members of the Smithsonian Board of Regents who are committed to advancing the celebration of America's extraordinary heritage and progress. The order also directs the Secretary of Interior to restore federal parks, monuments, memorials, statues, markers, or similar properties that have been improperly removed or changed in the past 5 years to perpetuate a false revision of history or improperly minimize or disparage certain historical figures or events. In preparation for the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence on July 4th, 2026, the order dictates that the Secretary of Interior to complete restorations and improvements to Independence Hall by that date. Combating corrosive ideology is like the bold part for this next section. In the last decade, Americans have witnessed a concerted effort to rewrite American history and force our nation to adopt a factually baseless ideology aimed at diminishing American achievement. President Trump is fighting back to reestablish truth in the historical narrative and restoring federal sites dedicated to American heritage. So I'm actually not going to read this next section. You can go and Google the fact sheet for the order. I'm not going to attach it to our show notes because I don't want to promote it. But if you want to go see it, you can go look at it. The reason I'm not going to read through some of this is because the claims that are being made as far as what the Smithsonian Institute did are lacking in any nuance whatsoever. And so what they're promoting here in my mind is just cherry picking things to create more divisiveness, honestly. I think that kind of lays out what they're doing with this executive order.
Seems highly problematic. And the first thing I thought before it got even more unbelievable was your sentence where it said that, you know, under DJT, they want it to spark a child's imagination. And I thought that is pretty much what's going to happen. They are just going to derail and rewrite museum exhibits and purge, you know, non-American scholars and redo exhibits, I'm sure. And it made me think of a Donald Trump quote I found really funny when I saw some meme once where he says something akin to, when I look at myself when I was in the first grade and who I am now, I'm pretty much the same person. The temperament is the same. And I thought that plus child's imagination equals historical revisionism. Go for it. And it's really not normal, and it's highly alarmist. And when you got to the whole part about, like, they're now it's like, you know, don't divide by race, or you can't, you know, anything that would divide by race, you can't fund, and anything that would encourage or celebrate women. And it's just like out the door. It's time to impeach. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't even know how to start about it because it, on the one hand, it's just so unbelievably stupid and silly and just for a lot of it's just like you hear it and patently on its face as adults who have some modicum of awareness about the world, you immediately clock that it's just stupid. But children are going to read this or be taught this or whatever. Adults who agree with it are going to enforce it willingly, gleefully. And rhetorically, it sets up some very nasty, covert, I mean, in fiction, you call it foreshadowing, right? So he talks about not dividing based on race, not promoting the idea that men are women, which is just code for we hate trans people. So it sets up this circumstance where whiteness and normalness are the norm. I want to invoke ability studies here too, because like they haven't explicitly come after disabilities, but that's going to be on the chopping block too. Anyone who is not an able-bodied, willing member of the regime will be isolated and picked out and taken down. If you challenge their ideology in any way, you're going to be targeted. You can just sort of see the snowball building as all these things keep happening. So yeah, it's really scary. It's really scary to even begin to think about what they're going to do to people who insist on teaching Black history. I mean, I'm scheduled to teach this fall, and I'm going to teach Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States and do it the same way I've always been doing it for the past few years, and we'll see what happens. But yeah, as a professor, like before all this stuff happened, there were activist right-wing groups who were trying to grab leftist professors and put them on lists and get their careers ruined and everything. And that's kind of been on my mind a lot more lately. I never worried about it before, but now part of my mind is like, is somebody gonna put my name on a list? Am I gonna be having to deal with this at some point? But you know, I'm a white guy with privilege, so fuck it. I'm gonna teach the history. I'm not gonna shy away from it. But the other thing I want to say, just to set up for this episode that you guys are going to hear this week and next, this is an example of how history works. It is a story. History is full of stories, and we have to be rigorous about how we tell them and how we read them and understand them. That team is trying to put together a story, and the more people that believe it, the more real it will become, regardless of how silly we think it is. On the one hand, we can clock that it's erroneous and fake and all that stuff. But on the other hand, we have to have our own story that is better than that one. And it has to be grounded in reality. It has to be grounded in compassion and shared values and helping each other. We have to be very, very careful about how we understand stories and how we tell them, because we got to do both of those things. We can't just say that their stories are bad. We have to have our own that make more sense and better sense.
Yeah, I agree with both things that you guys said. And I think this would be something that we'd really want to pay attention to as it goes forward. Just reading the fact sheet on this or whatnot, you could make a lot of arguments, whatever argument they're trying to make on how this is promoting American greatness, I think. The world of American greatness. Yeah, that's literally what it said there. Okay. But we're going to see exactly what that means when they start making changes. That's like, I mean, it's hard to continue to spin something when you can actually see like a implemented change, whether that's a Confederate monument coming back up. I mean, like the what was it? The one piece here, Secretary of Interior, restore federal parks, monuments, memorial statues that have been removed over the last 5 years, right? A vast majority of those are Confederate statues that probably shouldn't have been up and were put up during the, what was that, Reagan era?
That was like in the 1920s or something. There was like, it was when the KKK really, really got revived in the early 20th century. There was like this, it was like a white women's group, I think, actually, that like campaigned and raised money and tried to get all these Confederate monuments built and everything or whatever. I was just going to say, because in the history episode, we're going to talk about the idea of family, about the story of the nation as a family. That's a metaphor we're going to talk about in the history episode. And this is an example of the big daddy trying to rally around the family, right? I've got Rage Against the Machine in my head since I was a kid. And it's just like, I hear that song, you know, rally around the family with a pocket full of shells. That's what they're doing.
Yeah, totally. I love that. And it wouldn't be problematic if the executive order was like, you know, President Donald Trump wants to align the Smithsonian with more Republican values. But it's like, you know, our savior Donald Trump is restoring truth, some subjective thing, and sanity. Okay. And here's how. It's just such a myth. And it's like trying to lead that whole myth, like you're saying about, you know, this daddy, Donald.
I hate those words together. I'm sure we'll revisit this and see, you know, what the long-term effects are of this executive order, how it gets challenged in court, because it certainly will. Joe, you want to transition into the main segment here?
This week, we're going to talk about history. We're going to talk about the idea of history in the first episode of this two-part episode that you'll get. We're going to talk about what it means to us, where our ideas come from, how our worldviews are shaped. We talked about that a little bit in the first episode, but we're going to get into more detail here and really pick apart how perspectives are built and how we understand our own perspectives and our orientation to the world. In the second segment, we'll get into a book called A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn. I'll discuss some passages from the first chapter, and we'll talk about the origins of what we might want to call the United States, the history of the United States. You know, we're going back to Columbus, but he begins back with Columbus for a reason. So we're going to go back there and revisit what we learned about in 1492, Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue. So stay tuned.
You want to talk about some history?
Yeah, let's get into it.
Well, I guess we should talk about history in general. We'll talk about some history a little bit later, but let's talk about what we mean by history. So I'm a bit of a word nerd. I did a lot of school for English, and so I like to look up etymologies and understand how words have been used through history to try to understand the context of how the meaning has changed over time. And sometimes just that historical background can be helpful. So if you happen to have a university login of any kind, community college, an old school account you used to have, whatever, you probably have access to the Oxford English Dictionary online, which is a really, really great resource for looking up etymology and definitions. You get pages and pages and pages of information about every word you look up. So if you have a university login, I highly recommend checking out the OED online. But our current usage of this word history mostly comes from Old and Middle French, and the word is spelled pretty much the same. Sometimes the I is a Y, but it originally, back in the 12th century, meant an account of events of a person's life. It's a chain of events, but that chain of events is connected to a particular person. And you might say, and when I think about the word history, you break it down, his story, that might be like a corny way to break it down, but it kind of makes sense because back in the day, that's sort of what it meant. Like, what is he talking about? His story, sort of relating the events of his life. This became more formalized over time, less of like a spoken thing and more of like, oh, I'm just going to write down a narrative of events of my life, and that is my history. And so if you've heard of annals, like A-N-N-A-L-S, it's almost like an encyclopedia of events, right? It's just like annals for the year 2024. It's just a list of thing happened, thing happened, thing happened, thing happened. There's no attempt to sort of cohere the whole collection into a meaningful story. So that's different than history per se. History is more of like, what is the connective tissue between all these events? So whenever you're talking about a history of this thing or a history of that person or a history of this nation, you're thinking, what is the meaningful narrative that connects all this stuff together? And I think that's an important point about what history does, because it's important to not think of history as simply like data or facts objectively about the past. Because when you start assuming it in that kind of framework, it quickly limits your perspective in certain ways. You're blind to the ways that view of the past is preventing other ways of looking. So I guess the main reason for emphasizing this is just that when you're dealing with history, you're always dealing with a particular point of view that will favor certain groups over others. Most of what we know about history, there's the phrase history is written by the victors, right? And there's some truth to that, because most of what we get is whoever the conquerors are in a given situation, they get to write down all the stories about what happened. They get to tell us what was important about it, how these people were just brave explorers, you know, this and that. We'll get into Christopher Columbus a little bit today. But there's a point of view that limits what you can know about the other side. You know, who are all those voices that were silenced in the process of those events taking place? And so when you keep that in mind, when you're thinking about history, you can have your point of view, you can have your preferred ways of looking, but in the back of the mind, I would recommend also remembering there are things you're blind to when you look in this way. And occasionally you have to sort of try to step out of that a little bit and see what other people are looking at, especially if you're in conversations and it's sort of breaking down and you can't really come to some kind of agreement. There's probably a fundamental difference in the way you're looking at a situation that prevents you and whoever you're talking with of coming together on that point of view. So history is an activity in one sense. It's a kind of writing or a storytelling, and it's also developed into an academic discipline. There are professional historians, people who go to graduate school for history, get their PhDs, and then call themselves a historian. And their job is to do that sort of narrating of the past in a way that they are honest about their point of view, and they're honest about why they make the choices they make. You can quickly distinguish a honest historian from a propagandist, because the honest historian will tell you what their point of view is and they'll tell you why they chose it. The propagandist will try to make it seem like this is the objective truth. This is the way everyone ought to look at this. And if they're not willing to be kind of transparent about their point of view, that's, in my opinion, a cause for suspicion. So from the point of view of decent historians who are trying to do good work, there's this ethical responsibility at the center of the work, right? To be transparent about your perspective, about the limitations of that perspective, whatever biases come with it. And being transparent about that encourages other people to do the same thing, and you end up having a more helpful conversation. And just in terms of writing and reading, I'm much more willing as a reader to trust a book I'm reading if the person writing it is upfront with me about their worldview, about their opinions, about the things they care about. I don't get the sense that they're trying to hide their biases from me or something like that. Develops a little bit of trust.
Please stay tuned for a word from our sponsors.
Attention, parents! Are you worried that your child is learning too much history?
I sure am. Yesterday, my son came home asking about labor strikes and systemic issues. What's next? Questioning authority?
Not with Heritage Vault, the only textbook subscription service that updates in real time to match today's most acceptable version of history.
Wow. So I can choose a version of history that aligns with my values?
That's right. Want a history where slavery was actually an internship program? We've got it! Prefer a world where the British were the real victims of the Revolutionary War? No problem.
Finally, a history we can trust. What I thought we could do, if you guys are cool with that, is just to start practicing sharing our worldviews with each other. As we get to having conversations about the present, the past, whatever these points of these ways of looking that we each have are sometimes going to line up and sometimes not. And I think one thing we can offer the listeners and the viewers is, you know, how to navigate these situations, especially where they don't line up, with some decency, with some, you know, introspection. Well, let me take a step back here and see, you know, maybe I'm coming at it in the wrong way and I need to rethink my perspective a little bit. So I thought we could just start by sharing our points of view a little bit, whatever you want to say about it. I tend to describe my worldview either as like biased towards working people, or depending on who I'm talking to, I might say Marxist, because the writings that Karl Marx produced ended up having a lot of influence on me in grad school. Not in the sense that it changed my opinions about the world, but from my experience, it felt like it gave me more of the language I had been looking for to describe what I already knew was wrong with the world, or what I already felt like was wrong with the world. And so I'll just talk briefly about that perspective. I mean, part of it is a learned, like, individual personal perspective growing up in a sort of impoverished situation. Families on food stamps, barely making ends meet, and sort of seeing from the inside of the family what precariousness looks like financially, what it means to live paycheck to paycheck, to worry about the mortgage not getting paid, to see cars get repossessed and that kind of thing. And to just sort of see what debt and financial insecurity can do to people on just like a basic life level, like how bad it can get and everything. And by far did not have the worst experience. Many people had it way worse than I had it. But that experience growing up really influenced the way I look at the world. I remember as a kid automatically feeling kind of suspicious of anyone that seemed wealthy. Like, I don't know if you guys watch The Office, but there's a scene I love where the microwave gets really dirty and Pam tries to leave like a passive aggressive note, you know, whoever dirty the microwave, you need to clean it up. And there's this wonderful exchange, like where Meredith is, kind of like, I don't know, Richie Rich needs to calm down with these passive aggressive notes or whatever. And Pam's like, just because we like things clean doesn't mean they're rich. And she was like, nah, they're rich. And like that sort of just general mistrust of anyone with any money was something as a kid that like really made sense to me. Like, I knew the world wasn't fair and I didn't really understand how to describe why it wasn't fair, but it had something to do with rich people being greedy. And that feeling has generally stayed with me. I've articulated it in a lot of different ways over the course of life. But what a lot of the Marxist reading I did in grad school helped me with was to understand why that intuition made a good bit of sense, especially coming from the US culture where in grade school and public school we're indoctrinated in a lot of ways. I didn't really get taught much about how democracy works, but I got some vague lessons about Democrats do this, Republicans do that. But I didn't get a lot of like, you know, here's how to be financially stable in life. Here's how to really not get taken advantage of with loan sharks and payday lenders and things like that. A lot of what I feel like we got in grade school comes from this sort of individualistic, competitive ideology, right? You're an individual in the marketplace. It's cutthroat. You've got to grind and take care of yourself to make it work. Otherwise, you're going to drown and it's never going to work. And you can't really work together with people too much. You always got to find a way to like elbow other people out of the way or box them out or whatever. And that was the general like financial strategy advice I remember getting in school from teachers and coaches and stuff. What I did not get was all of the union organizing history that's happened in the United States. Like since literally before the United States was founded, there have been working people in the colonies, poor white people, enslaved people, indigenous people, and women who would work together to try to help their situations. And so keeping those groups divided has always kind of been historically a strategy that the wealthy people who were the original colonists and became, you know, the ruling class of the United States, they view it's bad for them if we all get together and start working together on some of these issues. And so recognizing that that piece was missing from my education really kind of fired me up to learn more of that perspective that I didn't get. So I tend to lean towards a Marxist perspective because I feel like it helps me correct all of the sort of propaganda or biased conditioning, if you will, that I got growing up. And that's still very much there today. Like I taught high school for a short period of time a few years ago, and a handful of the teachers were still spouting some of these same like competitive, you got to look out for number one and not worry about anybody else. Like there's still very much that kind of ideology going on. And I think it's like not for the individual teachers, it's not intentionally malicious. They're not trying to like pit kids against each other. They're really trying to protect them because they see how much these kids suffer and they want them to do well. But we don't really have that sort of collectivist ideology of to really make this work, we got to work together. I don't often get that message. I guess that's the positive of how I look at that worldview. It helps me broaden my perspective, emphasize labor and the working class, and sort of correct some of the propaganda I've gotten in the past. One of the limitations of this worldview that I feel like happens is it tends to overemphasize labor in a way that can limit other people's experiences. So sometimes we might be saying that unions are the most important thing, but it limits the way we can appreciate how Black people have been oppressed that is maybe separate from labor. And so sometimes the conversation can get collapsed or oversimplified around labor in a way that isn't helpful. That's one of the limitations of that point of view. But in general, I'll just close and say that like the main thing I find useful about this sort of favoring the working class or the concept of work in general that people have to do in the global society now is that it universalizes the human experience all across the world, regardless of which regime you're talking about, whether we're in the US or Russia or China or North Korea or whatever. There are people doing labor. There are people doing work, and they are having that work exploited by someone. And if we can have more conversations about that experience that most of the world has in common, I think we'll do a better job of figuring out what we can do together and stop worrying so much about how to compete against each other. So that's just my worldview in a nutshell. So
I like how your worldview, I like how it, you said that you had this intuition and feeling about the world, and then you read stuff and wasn't occluded anymore, and then it made sense. So I really like how you had this feeling and your worldview is affirming it because of the knowledge that you attained. That's really cool.
It feels good to have feelings validated. I do that for each other. But yeah, Arthur, you're already, if you want to go ahead, I was just going to say a name. But
yeah, if you want two worldviews similar back to back, let's do it. I've always been a big fan of the universe and stars. And that's just kind of like my childhood has been a lot of philosophy of the universe. And it's like watching Carl Sagan. And so I think that was important for me because I recognized that my existence is one, it's just completely chaotic. Like it's a happenstance of the universe. Like it could be, it could not be. So that's like one thing of my worldview. And the second is that I think that your whole worldview is kind of formed, at least I believe this, by the circumstances that you're surrounded by. So like me, I was born in California to a family, you know, I could have been born anywhere at any time, whatever. I recognize that as well. And I think that those recognitions have allowed me to just kind of be like, are these values that I have mine, or are they values that I've been inculcated with? I go through and I weigh every value that I have. And I think, is this mine, or is this an American value, or is it a capitalist value? Or is, so seeing the layers, I think, is really important for me. And I would say that, yeah, I was definitely encouraged to think more left-leaning. And I think that that also really affirmed my natural empathetic desires in the world. And it's definitely a lot of solidarity with the working class specifically. I don't have like politically, like in the bicameral system, you know, I'm not like a fan of either really. I have voted Democrat in the past, but I have a lot of solidarity still for even the MAGA people, because I view them to be in a circumstance themselves that they might not see, or maybe they do, and that's totally fine. But I think, yeah, just a lot of solidarity for people and a lot of disdain for the wealthy. And I think that's because of what, like, you're highlighting, you know, is that they are exploiting, and nobody can become a billionaire without exploitation. It's just not possible.
So two comments before I get it to mine. First, I think this applies to both, but it is something I've been thinking about as I've been just understanding capitalism as a system. What one thing I was thinking about the other day, Joe and Arthur, you both hit on like greed and that being a major factor, is I was trying to think of a movie outside of any superhero movie, like Marvel movies and stuff like that, where the good guy is also a billionaire and or like hoarding money is a good thing. And I don't know if I could find one, but I could think of about a billion examples in Disney where it's always the rich guy that happens to be the evil person. And yet we live in a society where the more money you have, supposedly the more successful and better you are. So I don't know. I thought that was, you know, applies to those two.
That is pretty weird because they're writing and they're producing and they're making these things to be our values. And yeah, they are kind of framing them as bad people.
How do those stories get resolved though? Like maybe I enjoy movies. I love movies. I don't keep up with them that well. So there's like a ton of movies that I probably should have seen that I still haven't seen. Same with books. Like I did a PhD in English. And if you ask me about my field, there's like dozens and dozens of books that I haven't read that are in my field or whatever. But when those stories get resolved, is it usually just like an individual hero or two saving the day? Or is it like a class solidarity, the masses rising up to overthrow the landlords kind of thing, you know? Like they're giving us the wrong solutions.
Yeah,
that's true.
Well, the one that was coming to my mind was Smaug from Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Like all the dragons always hoard gold.
I love Lord of the Rings. So those are my comfort movies. I'll rewatch the extended editions any day. Like just feel good movies for sure.
Please stay tuned for a word from our sponsors. Are you tired of elections being decided by the wrong people?
Yeah, every time I vote, my guy doesn't win.
That's where Deceive America PAC comes in. We ensure that elections remain fair, balanced, and most importantly, profitable.
But wait, doesn't that mean rich donors get more say than average Americans?
That's democracy, my friend. Some voices are just worth more than others.
America PAC is fully compliant with campaign finance laws because we wrote them. Side effects may include disillusionment with the political process, voter suppression, and legalized corruption.
All right, let me jump into what I think my worldview is really quick. And actually, Arthur, something you said, I'm going to kind of use as the basis here, like where you grew up, like the groups that you were part of, like how that shaped your worldview. I grew up in a very small town. And thinking back to how I grew up, my parents rarely had, like, we didn't have TV. And that's not because we couldn't get a TV. Like, my parents were comfortable. We were like solid middle class. My dad was a teacher. You know, like, money wasn't something that, it was something we were aware of for sure. Like, there were definitely times when money was tight, but we never got to the point where we were like worried we were going to lose our house. They always had enough for that. Like, so, like, growing up, was secure, right? There was definitely a level of security there that I was fortunate to have. And something that shaped me quite a bit was September 11th. It was, I think for a lot of people, they can remember that, but I was sitting in my fifth grade classroom and my teacher kept coming in and out, like taking a phone call and then like coming back in and was sitting down. And like, we knew something was going on. We didn't know what the hell it was. I won't forget that. He basically had us all stop what we were doing and kind of like slowly explained, you know, what's going on right now. There's been an attack, and walked through that. I think a couple, I don't know if it was a year later or something, but I was one of those guys that got like USA carved into the back of my hair, like a haircut with that, literally. I definitely got caught up in kind of the fever of, you know, I don't know if I would have thought about it as revenge at the time, but that's essentially what it was, right? Like, it was like we were hit as a country, and I certainly fell into the thought process of like, we are all the same country. We're all going to fight back against this evil that came and attacked us and killed all these innocent people for no reason. And that obviously fundamentally changed a lot about my direction and where I was going. So then I joined the Marine Corps right out of high school, pretty much, and spent a little over 14 years working in government. And I wouldn't have spent two enlistments plus another 5 years working for the federal government if I didn't believe that what I was doing was in some way a net positive. Spent that entire time working in counterterrorism. And during that time, you know, I went to Afghanistan, went to Iraq, saw countries that are not secure in any way, right? Like, saw what people in the Middle East live with and need security wise at just a hotel, right? Like, automatic weapons, big walls around it, Constantino wire, just to go to a Marriott in Jordan. Seeing how others live in some places and the level of security they don't have is something that, growing up in the United States, most people, at least in my position, like the middle class, feel pretty secure when you live in the country that has the largest military in the world, and probably don't think about people that live in countries that are constantly under threat or constantly in conflict, right? And so I think my worldview is really looking at what could we do as the richest country in the world to actually make people's lives better? And what could we do with the power that may not have been gained in ethical, or certainly was not gained in any ethical or moral way, but how do you use what you've got at this point if your society decides that we want to do things that are better? Like, how can you use that power for good, right? That's kind of what my thought has always been, the idealistic Captain America thought of what America is, standing up for the little guy, and like that whole propaganda spiel of what it could be, but bought into that for sure. And then when you see things where the U.S. is not at all doing that, or is actively harming smaller countries, it breaks that. But to me, it doesn't mean that we can't live up to that ideal, right? It would take societal change to get us there, or a lot of good people would have to stand up and get behind that kind of theory. But that's my rambling version of kind of what I think.
Yeah, I heard things in what both of you guys said that I agree with a lot. I mean, yeah, I didn't mention 9/11, but obviously we were all kids at the time, and that affected us in different ways. I saw so many older friends and community members just jump headfirst into the military as soon as they could, and I was right behind them. I mean, 1 week after I graduated high school, I was in Paris Island, you know, like, I was ready to go as soon as I could. But just like you, there's a lot of idealism in there. I really identify with the good guy, right? And I really want my team to be the good guys, right? There's that, I don't know what TV show it's from, but there's a meme of like a guy in a Nazi uniform and he's like, are we the baddies? Like just suddenly realizing you're on the wrong team. Like, what? What's going on here? So like, there's this disillusionment that comes with like learning more about how it all works. Cause of course there are really good people in government doing really good work with really great hearts and trying to do the right thing. And then there are these people with all this power that just have way more influence than all of the good people and way more control. And you see how much bad they can do despite the good people's best efforts. And so I think a lot of us are in the situation now. I mean, part of it's why we're doing this podcast. It's like the world can be better. It can be different. We can do good things with the resources that we have. You know, it makes no sense that there are 800 billionaires and over 500,000 homeless people in this country, right? It makes no sense. We can do it differently. And so we're all just slamming our head up against the wall, trying to think, how can we do it? How can we do it? Let's figure it out. Let's figure it out. And that's why I think it's beautiful about this podcast. It can be better to the extent that we can do anything about it. We're going to try to make it better, but it's hard. It's hard to figure it out. Even once you figure out what the problem is, to figure out what to do about it.
Especially when we live in a society where the incentives, like we just talked about, what's the incentive in where we are? It's to get as rich as possible. And literally, if you want a political voice, it's also to get as rich as possible now, because like, you know, ever since the Citizens United is overturned, my political voice is very muted compared to anybody that's got enough money to throw into a super PAC. My $3,500 max that I can send to X candidate is nothing compared to the $1 million that somebody can drop into a super PAC to create completely false ads or something like that. Right.
I think it starts with taxing the rich. Pick a number and like, you know, let's have it be 500 million. Let's have it be 2 billion. Let's have it be 5 billion. Whatever you make over it, just like 100% taxed. And pick a number. I really don't care. Like Elon made like 200 billion or something, you know, whatever.
The thing that drives me crazy about that statement is like, we have a model like back in the 60s and 50s, like we were
Republican
taxing like,
like
over 70%. And then like, people talk about, oh, I want to get back to like that idealistic 1950s world. And it's like, well, there's one thing we could try. Let's look at what the tax structure was back then.
No, that's a great example, too. The whole MAGA worldview as like a version of history. It's a narrative about the past. It's just shot through with fantasy and delusion and myth making. And it's like, yeah, there were good aspects of that society, but the good aspects are not the things you actually like when we bring them up, like 90% tax for the wealthy.
Yeah.
No, you want to pick on minorities and just be mean to people. What does that do for you materially? You're still struggling to pay rent, even though you're mean to other people. Can we talk about what will actually help you? I also wanted to jump on what you said, Arthur, about, I loved how you started with Carl Sagan and the universe. And just, I was on that train too, just like totally mesmerized by outer space, just like on a clear night, looking at the stars as a kid and being like, what is that? Like, just like, full of, I don't know, there's something magical about I'll still do that. I get up pretty early. I get up like 4 a.m. and it's really dark outside. And so sometimes I just like to stand. This is actually going to connect to Elon Musk in a strange way. I like to stand on my back deck and just sort of look at the stars on a clear morning or whatever, just to start the day, do some deep breathing, feel fresh and everything. One day I was up early in the morning on my back deck looking up at the stars, and it was a beautiful night. And then out of nowhere, I just see these bright chain of lights in the sky, just like a train just zoom across the sky way up there, like level with the stars from my point of view. And I panicked. I was like, what the, is that the mothership? What is going on? What is this? Start Googling on my phone and it's fucking Starlink satellites getting launched.
Yeah.
Got to really upset that day.
He's got to ruin the whole sky.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of like, I've read, just because I am into astronomy and one of my goals in life is to go to the Atacama Desert where the light pollution on Earth is the lowest. So you can actually feel it and it's like unbelievable. And they have a hotel. Right? And no, it's in Chile. And they got there's like a 6-hour bus you got to take to the remote hotel that's just for the people viewing the stars. And anyway, there's just a lot of complaints online about like, well, Starlink ruined this and this and this. And now the guy owns like, you know, I don't want to put out misinformation here, but he owns like more than 50% of all satellites in the sky. And now he's in our Treasury Department.
Honestly, that was one of the most disappointing things about Elon's turn for me. When he came out initially, like he was very much the, I'm going to be a billionaire superhero. He's trying to be like Tony Stark or some shit. But I was like, oh man, if we can actually like accelerate getting to Mars and like becoming an interplanetary species, that would be super cool. Yeah, it's all bullshit. I don't think he gives a shit about that at all.
Yeah. And I think the problem is that I heard this in an astronomy class I took in college, was that to get to Mars, you have to pass through like a really high level of radiation. And to do that, you'd have to build the spaceship out of essentially lead, which you can't do. So it's like, what are you going to do?
Yeah. I read Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy, and he did a really realistic job of trying to explain what it would look like to colonize Mars. And part of the first book had to do with that journey and the radiation and everything. There was something about the spaceship that was like layered, and like during the trip, everyone had to like hibernate in the center of the spaceship with like multiple layers of shell around them and everything. But the radiation was like a huge thing they were worried about. They thought like we might not even survive before we make it.
Yeah. Science fiction writers have written so much like actual stuff that happens, and they're just so creative. Yeah.
I love that trilogy because it seemed like a very realistic, like if American corporations decided to colonize Mars, like this is kind of what it would look like. There was a lot of political fighting and guerrilla warfare on Mars. Like it's a wild trilogy. I really, really recommend it. Love it. I think it's Red Mars, Blue Mars, Green Mars, because they've changed the planet while they're there. So it becomes blue.
So that covers the show for this week. But before we go, we do have a couple updates, just normal show updates, actually, that we wanted to get out to everybody. So one thing, we are working on a website. It's not fully done yet, but once it is, then we'll probably be doing a bit more marketing for the show and promotion. At this stage of a show's development, the best thing you guys could do if you like the show and you want to support it is just share it with some people that you know that might also enjoy the show. If you've got social media, feel free to plug it on social media. You can also find us on social media now. We have a Blue Sky account for the show. We've got Substack. If you'd like to keep in touch there, by all means, check it out. When the website is fully operational, we'll make sure to let everybody know that. We'll have some other ways that people can support the show in fun and interesting ways, hopefully. So, but before we leave for today, we also have one other update. We are working on a book club. What we've decided to do is a book club portion of the show where we're going to do episodes talking through the books that we're reading. And also Joe's going to be doing some live reading. So Joe, do you want to talk a little bit about that, what that's going to look like?
Yeah, so really excited about book club. You know, part of this whole thing is recognizing that we're in a world just saturated with propaganda, and everyone, no matter how woke you think you are, we all have work to do in unpacking the narratives we have in our head. So we've got to study, we've got to do the reading, we've got to talk about what we've learned, and we got to keep that process going. It's a lifelong process of understanding the world. And so we're trying to practice what we're preaching with the book club. We're going to have an ongoing list of books. We're going to read them together. We're going to talk about them together. In case you don't have the money to purchase a hard copy book or an ebook, and you just kind of want to listen along as we read, Saturday mornings on Twitch, 10:30 Eastern time, I will be live reading the books we read. I'll try to do those in roughly 1 to 2 hour chunks. I may add more reading dates depending on how tight the schedule gets, but for now I'm going to do Saturday mornings, 10:30 on Twitch. The handle is @propagandalovesyou, just like everywhere else. So tune in, listen to the books, join us for book club.
That's awesome. I love Twitch, and I love that all the VODs will be there too. So if, you know, they can't catch you there, it's all started.
Bad news about the first one. I didn't set it up right, and it didn't get saved. So I read a whole book, and I think Cody listened.
I did.
So at least one person benefited from it other than me. But yeah, I was kind of pissed. I was like, where is it at? Oh, I didn't hit the toggle button to save the videos before I recorded.
Oh, man. Well, actually, if you want to listen to the book and you missed that, John Lithgow actually just did a recording of this as well. So that's on YouTube. So like, if you want to go and listen to On Tyranny before we do the episode where we talk about it, which we're actually about to record here in a minute, that's another option. That's it for the week. Stay informed, not influenced, and remember that propaganda loves you.